listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me for today's show is the one and only Chris Robley. Chris, how you doing?
Very good. I think this show has been a long time in the making.
Yes, it has been a long time in the making. It only took us, this is episode number 157, and only took us 156 episodes before we got to figure out a way that we could make an episode about Star Wars that was relevant, very relevant.
That's really all we've ever wanted to talk about, but it took a long time to figure out how to.
So this whole podcast has just been a long con for all our listeners to see how we could work in an episode about Star Wars. So yeah, we are going to be talking about Star Wars. It's going to be more relevant than you ever imagined, and we will get to that in a bit. Before that, Chris, how you doing? I think since we last talked on the podcast, you actually released, fulfilled your pledge campaign. Am I correct?
Yeah, kind of, sort of. I uploaded the digital release, so the music is out there. I am in the process of manufacturing the discs, and an official release it's going to be in early 2016, so.
That's true. I bought a t-shirt. I'm still waiting for my t-shirt.
Yeah, you're never going to get that.
That's what I figured. I had something kind of cool happen recently. I was at a music tech conference down in San Francisco, and I was talking to someone. Her name was Melissa. She was an artist, and we were talking about marketing music and all that. And she was saying, I was telling her about the Song Exploder podcast and that she needed to check it out. And she was like, oh my gosh, my sister just texted me saying I should check out that podcast. That's so funny that you say that. And I'm like, well, not just that podcast. You need to listen to this one exact episode.
You've plugged this episode now like 18
yes,
times.
Yes, yes. I need to get like a commission for their sales off of that episode, but it was the episode with the Long Winters, and it's an amazing episode about people. If you're trying to figure out how to tell your story in a compelling way that draws people into music, I can point to one thing very easily, and that is it. That episode, listen to that. She pulled out her phone and she said, "Look," and she pointed. Brought up the text from her sister, and it was her sister was texted her that exact episode saying, "You must listen to this." And so it's not just me. Word on the street is that's a good episode. But it was just crazy that
your tastes have been affirmed or validated.
It wasn't just the podcast that her sister texted. It was that same exact episode. And I'm a fan of that podcast. And I will say that, you know, a lot of the episodes, I feel, there's not as much emotion or energy behind them. It's like someone's talking about the process, which can be interesting. But I think a lot of times it can be an example of how artists can be really poor about talking about what they do and just like, yeah, so we recorded a guitar, then we recorded drums, and then there was the song. And you're like, well, that, you know, that didn't tell me much about what you uniquely brought to the process. So, but anyway, it's a good podcast, and I think it'll help people, you know, learn about the songwriting process and what other artists are doing. But that episode, see, it's not just me. Other people are saying the same thing.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if it was a previous episode where we were discussing this, but the formula we decided that we derived from the episode is that when you're telling your story, you need to start with a little kernel of something that's universally relevant to human experience and then sort of draw it back into the specifics of how it relates to you or your music or whatever.
Yeah,
that was the lesson.
Yeah, I don't think we talked about that on the podcast. I think you and I were just talking about that. That yeah, starting with I was born in 19 whatever is not a universal kernel of truth or something, but that's what's so, or a universal experience, or like I guess everyone's been born, but it's not interesting. Nobody cares about the year you're born. They want to know something where they can all relate to you about. And so, yeah, check that episode out. So I just thought that was really cool because she literally pulled out her phone with the text with an image of the podcast that said that episode with the Long Winters. So other things we've got going on. We've got some calls. We've got some really good calls that we're going to get to later. And of course, we're going to be talking about Star Wars and your music career. And you will not believe how relevant this is. I'm going to keep hyping it so people will be like, I can only set them up to be let down.
Just like the prequels.
Yes. So anyway, with that, let's get into some news.
CD Baby.
Music.
It's become common to see headlines about how it's so much harder to sell albums in a world with streaming. But Adele's new 25 album is set to surpass 5 million copies sold in the U.S. by the end of this week, according to industry forecasters. Sources suggest the album could sell another 650,000 copies in the week ending this week. I guess the end date would be December 10th, which is actually yesterday. In its two previous weeks, it sold an amazing 4.49 million copies, according to Nielsen Music. Adele's 25 spent its second week at number one on Billboard 200 chart. 25 debuted with a record 3.38 million sold, the single largest sales week since Nielsen started tracking sales in 1991, and sold another 1.11 million in its second week. It's no surprise, then, that 25 should also easily rule the weekly Billboard 200 chart for the third week in a row. Pandora recently announced that it was acquiring the assets of now-failed subscription service Ardio. While the whispers about Ardio's future have been building for some time, the deal is more interesting for what it says about Pandora's plan than what it says about the state of the subscription business. For what Ardio lacked in subscriber numbers, it made up for in innovation. It continually set product and feature precedents that Spotify and others tried to copy. And its $75 million ad inventory deal with U.S. radio giant Cumulus set a business model blueprint that other streaming services will follow. But for all its efforts and extensive marketing, Ardio was simply not able to get to the same sort of traction as Spotify. A new study says that most people don't care about audio quality. A survey released by Atenga that surveyed U.S.-based consumers of streaming music found that most consumers are not at all concerned about the audio quality when they are listening. And Chris, I've got some things here, some of the things that people commented on about how they typically listen to music. So the question one was, how do you typically listen to music? Number one, with a bullet, my computer with speakers. The second was smartphone. Third, smartphone connected to speakers in my car. It gets smaller and smaller. My stereo was a very small portion of the numbers. But it was probably about 45% said my computer. And then the question number two was, what service do you most often use to stream music? Pandora was number one. YouTube, number two. Spotify, others. iTunes Radio was fourth. And then it goes on down from there. And I think there's one more question. And it was, how important is audio quality to you on your streaming service? Number one answer, somewhat, but music availability is more important. Number two, yes, I can make some compromises on what music is available if the quality is high. Yes, quality is everything was the third most popular, and the fourth was not at all, as long as the music I want is available. So clearly, not a good sign for people trying to do streaming services like Tidal as it being a higher quality.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm of two minds about it. On the one hand, it might not be something that consumers are actively prioritizing, but I still think maybe sort of subtly, subconsciously, it has a an effect on, you know, sort of it colors the experience of the music in some way. That's one side of it. On the other side, I actually have been listening to this album by the band The War on Drugs, Lace, for the past couple weeks, and I'm listening to it on my iPhone speakers, which sounds like total crap, and I still love the album. I get to the end of it and I put it back on. So I just totally contradicted myself there, but
what is making you listen to an album over and over just on the iPhone speakers?
Well, I've been doing some housework, so
I do that as well. I put something on, usually podcasts, and I'll even just stick the phone in my pocket while it's on, while I'm walking around the house doing work.
Yeah, because I don't want to have the earbuds in while I'm working with tools and stuff, because then, you know, they'll be flying out of my ears, and I don't want it, you know, I don't want to have to bring a stereo or a portable radio or something everywhere I go, so my phone's easy.
Hmm. You find that you have a hard time keeping earbuds in while you're using tools?
Yeah, I'm pretty clumsy.
It is interesting that, you know, there's so many people that on the musician side and especially on the music production side that get so angry and frustrated with the state of audio quality and how we take this very nice studio and expensive gear and capture these amazing performances and they get reduced down to extremely compressed audio through really cheap headphones. And I know there's a comic that gets or a little like meme that gets circulated all the time. It pops up every once in a while where it's like studio X number of dollars, and then it kind of goes down through the process, and it's like cheap headphones. You know, kind of explaining that all this work goes into capturing great audio quality to put it through the worst possible methods of for the listening environment. But
yeah, but at the same time, like you think of people listening to. What did they have? Gramophones, or you know, in the '20s, or even earlier. Those the sound coming out of those tin, you know, cones that probably sounded really terrible. You know, well, that did sound terrible, but I think people had an equally powerful emotional response to it, which contradicts what I said earlier. So,
well, I agree.
Take it back.
It's a problem that's been around forever. The idea that streaming music is this new issue we face is not the case. I remember when Small Town Poets, our first albums were out and our songs were on the radio, I would just cringe at how they sounded on the radio compared to what they sounded like with a CD, because the radio stations compress the audio and then the stations never, it's pretty rare that a station is like extremely 100% clean, that there's not a little bit of crackle or noise in the background that it's adding, and when as you're driving around that happens. And then you know, people listen to crappy stereos as well, and the era of AM radio and all that kind of stuff. So it's not some sort of new thing that's popped up because of technology, but it is, people felt like with the CD world, we kind of got to a point where, yes, audio quality, there was this pursuit of better audio quality. And I remember when, you know, my dad bought a CD player for the first time and fancy headphones and was just blown away about how much better it sounded than tapes and everything else that came before it. And, you know, it's now about convenience and accessibility, and that's gonna win the day for a while. We'll see. You never know what'll happen. Trends come and go. But I should also say, just because your headphones cost a lot of money does not mean they are good headphones either.
I know what brand you're talking about.
I got a pair for Christmas last year. I asked for a different pair that were cheaper, and someone got me a pair of these very expensive, overpriced headphones that start with a B and end with eats. And they broke with very limited use, and I've seen lots of people say the same thing, and they sounded terrible. So buy headphones with your ears, not with your eyes and what kind of fashion statement you can make. That's a public service announcement. That was free for everyone.
Well done.
The audio thing is interesting because people are speculating, and it's pretty much what's going to happen, that Pandora is going to launch its own interactive streaming service. And, you know, as streaming services come and go and new music platforms pop up, it's always like, okay, who are the players that could really make a go at it? You know, with YouTube launching their whole service, and you think, okay, YouTube has the power and the deep pockets to be in it for the long haul and try and get market share. And I didn't really see this coming with Pandora. I think that's a smart move for them. I've always heard great things about RDO. I've never really used it myself, but Phil, our director of digital distribution here at CD Baby, absolutely loved the RDO service, because the interface is so, and has a lot of, you know, he just really raved about the interface and how it works and recommendations and all that. So if Pandora is buying this and plans on relaunching, it could be something that does well and gains market share.
Yeah, and it's an obvious way of sort of funneling people into the paid subscription model, because everyone's already on Pandora. You hear a song that you like that's served up sort of, you know, not at random, but, you know, according to their genome, and then you want to check out the whole album. Suddenly, you know, you'll be able to bounce from the normal Pandora service to this new thing, and then they've got you.
Yeah, it is. It seems like a really good sales funnel for that type of service. So be interesting to see how long it takes for them to turn this around and launch it. My guess would be it would be at least a year, but you never know. They might have already had some things in the works before the deal was made final. And lastly, the Adele thing. It's I think the biggest thing for me was I didn't realize there was so many Adele fans. I think she's very talented. Her last album has some amazing songs on it, but I didn't realize there was this much anticipation for a new release.
I knew it was going to be. I mean, her last album was massive.
And, yeah.
And also not just massive, but massive amongst the demographic of people who are still going to buy CDs and who are still going to go and download a full album. I mean, I know she's huge with everyone, but particularly that sort of like 35, 40-year-old and up audience. So, which is perfect for her strategy of kind of holding it back from some of the streaming services. And
yeah, and the info I read didn't have the breakdown of CDs versus downloads, but the last time I heard the number, which wouldn't be current, it was like 1.6 million of the sales from the first week were CD sales, not just all downloads. So pretty interesting. A lot of the conversation around it is because she did hold back from it being available on Spotify and other places like YouTube. It was blocked on YouTube as well. She had her official music video that was out, but as far as like the whole album being available on YouTube Music, it was not there. And so just kind of interesting to see what can happen. I mean, it broke serious sales records. It wasn't just like, hey, this was the highest number one since digital music existed. It's like, it's going to break all time album sales records, most likely. It's not going to take down Thriller, I don't think. But as far as like first week sales, I mean, it was higher than anything since Nielsen started, you know, tracking.
I mean, it's definitely kind of like the Thriller of the digital age, though.
Yeah. You know, what would be interesting to see is, you know, since most people are buying their music online, even if they're getting a CD, they're just going to something like Amazon and ordering it. How quickly that tapers off, where, you know, back in the era of like a Thriller or a lot of the top albums of all time, people had to actually go to a store to get it, which takes longer and takes more time for people to get out to a store and buy it, as opposed to, you know, midnight it goes on sale and everyone just clicks download and buys it. It'll be interesting to see how quickly that tapers off. But and those numbers were just US numbers. She's selling like crazy in the UK and Germany and all across Europe. So
I know this is kind of like the cliche music advice thing that everyone always gives, but I always feel like the lesson is a little bit muddy, because Adele can do that. She can keep access to her music more exclusive and direct her fans to where she wants them to buy it. But most artists, you know, I'm not Adele. If I keep my music off of Spotify and off of YouTube, I'm going to be hurting myself in terms of access. I'm putting up barriers between me and my potential fans. And if they can't get it from YouTube or wherever they go, they're just going to find another artist or another song to listen to.
Yeah, I would agree with you that the lesson to learn from this is not, hey, I'm going to go remove all my music from streaming services. It's about supply and demand, and you've got to be able to gauge where you're at with your audience. And I think the number one thing to learn is what you said, sort of alluded to, is that she's telling people where to get her music, and she's saying, go buy a CD. She's not saying that directly, but that's how they've done it by what they released. I think it's important for artists to always remember that when you're marketing your music to especially your diehard fans, that you direct them to the places that it's going to benefit you the most for them to go engage and buy your music on, you know, like if you're going to make the most money from selling CDs, send them there first, or send them to there in a place where they can get a download. Send your diehard fans who are going to go anywhere you tell them to places like that where you can make the most money, and then make your music available for the casual person that's just trying to, you know, check you out. That's what Spotify and all those other places are for. So,
and then once you're as famous as Taylor Swift and Adele and Radiohead, then go ahead and remove your music from Spotify, or just keep a few songs up there. But
sure,
don't shoot yourself in the foot.
Sure. Whatever works for you. You know, if you want to remove your music, you know, I think it's a mistake. But speaking of
mistakes,
Chris, no, not mistakes. we'll wrap up the news section, but I was going to say, you know, this podcast is we're able to do this because the fine folks at CD Baby allow us to do it. So I just want to make sure that you know that we're here to help you distribute your music. That's what we do every day. I think when talking about making money from music, one of the things that I come across artists all the time when I'm out at conferences, people just emailing me that don't have their catalog available everywhere. And I'm like, what are you doing? It's a mistake. Get your music out there. Make it available, because if it's not, you're not going to make money. The easiest way to not make money from your music is to just put it in a box in your basement. And so no one can buy it, hear it, or see it, listen to it, do anything with it. You need to get your music out there, and not just your latest release, your whole catalog. So that's what we do here. Members.cdbaby.com to go sign it up. Get it out there worldwide. And, you know, the most of the artists that I know that are seeing consistent success from their music, I'm not talking about like some viral video that randomly happens, but consistent growth and increase in income are people that have keep building a catalog and make the entire catalog available and keep working the entire catalog. So that's what we do here, and we can help you out.
Well, I thought of one other quick related news announcement, which is that through Christmas Eve, if you happen to be listening to this podcast currently, we're doing 1 cent shipping on all CD and vinyl orders. So tell your fans where to go get your music.
Yeah, and people go crazy for that kind of stuff. It's like you could cut your CD's price in half and people are like, huh, okay. But then you tell them it's 1 cent shipping and they freak out. What? I don't have to pay shipping. It's funny how people are like that. It happens all the time. Retailers do it. So we're trying to do that for artists to help you sell more music during the holiday season. So, yeah, your fans won't know or won't feel motivated to do something if you don't communicate with them either. So that's another thing. Go email all your fans. Tell them where your music's available, how they can enjoy it this holiday season, and how they can help you by buying a CD, or they make great gifts and so forth. So with that being said, let's get to...
Let's transition to the mistakes.
Well, Star Wars. We're talking... So the title of this episode, I believe, is going to be the Star Wars episode, What Artists Can Learn from Epic Mistakes. I originally was going to title it What Musicians and Artists Can Learn from the Mistakes of George Lucas. And I thought that sounded kind of harsh. I didn't want it to be about trash-talking George Lucas, because I don't know George. He's actually seems to be like a pretty private person. He doesn't talk much publicly. For somebody who has such a giant franchise, or used to have such a giant franchise as Star Wars. And so a lot of what we're going to be talking about are just things that have bubbled up in the press, or things that have been noticed that he has talked about, and just some of the things that are out there about the creation of the creation process. So why we're doing...
Before we talk too much crap about George Lucas too, I just want to mention that this is obvious, of course, but he's also responsible for the very thing that we love so much that we, you know, are hypercritical of when it's disappointed us. That, and I also need to thank him for being involved in the creation of Joseph Campbell's Power of Myth videos.
Yeah.
So
And let's not forget the Star Wars Christmas special. I mean, we are heading into Star Wars.
Oh, man.
Oh, I probably should have included that on my list. But anyway, so why a Star Wars episode? Let me give you a little background about why this came up. It's actually been brewing for about 9 months. It's been about 9 months that I've been planning on doing this episode and just thought we would wait until we got closer to the release of the new movies. But Chris, on the early morning of May 19th, 1999, myself and a couple of the other members of Small Town Poets, we witnessed a travesty. And that was when we stayed up late to see a midnight showing of Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. I still remember us standing out in the parking lot after that at 3 a.m, just kind of going, what happened?
It hadn't sunk in yet.
It hadn't. We were just trying to process what
were
we just went
to every shred of like justifications for why you like wanted to pretend you liked it.
Yes, exactly.
That too.
Exactly. So if you're not catching on, the episodes 1 through 3, the ones where George Lucas came back and picked up the saga again, but tried to tell the prequels, were a huge disappointment to the fan community. And, you know, there's a lot of bickering back and forth about whether or not they're good or not. People will say, well, I like them. But anyway, that's besides the point. For this episode, let's put that aside because there are some concrete ideas that we're going to talk about today. So for years, Chris, I've struggled with the idea of, like, why are these movies so terrible? And sure, it's got a kid actor that's terrible. I don't care for movies when they put a child in the lead role. And there's Jar Jar Binks, but it's more than that. What's wrong with these films? And I came across some YouTube videos on a YouTube channel called Red Letter Media. They do reviews of movies, and they're pretty hysterical. I should tell you that I will put a link to this in the show notes, but they are, I would say, R-rated, PG-13 to R-rated, mainly because of bad language. And what it is it's...
Well, there's also a trigger warning. There's this kind of, like, rapey humor, which is, I don't know. That's the part of it that I kind of hate. But all of the actual film critique, I think, is amazing. But when it gets into the...
Yeah, and that's when it gets into the other movies. It starts to get, like, borderline NC-17 because of that. But what it is this YouTube channel is they created this character. So it's not a real person interviewing it. So it's this fake character that's like this couch potato slob guy that never leaves the house kind of character, and kind of like a Homer Simpson that's gone really wrong, if that's possible.
And throughout the series, you learn that he's actually a serial killer.
Yeah, that comes on later. But when you watch the Phantom Menace ones, they don't get into that as much. But anyway, I started watching it, and I was fascinated because it was something that if I taught a film class, I would make everybody watch. And it was so fascinating that the more I watched them, because there's like 6 videos just about the Phantom Menace, and I think they do 6 for the second movie and then 6 for the third, and they're 10 minutes each. So there's a lot of content in there, and them just really describing how things went wrong. And it was so fascinating that I thought, this isn't just about filmmaking. This is about the creative process in general and the mistakes that can happen when you're in the creative process and what you can do to make sure that you don't make the same mistakes and end up with a giant release of a movie that you know is kind of your legacy that just gets panned and destroyed. And not that anyone listening to this is probably working on a blockbuster film at the moment, but the idea is that you're putting your life and all your energy into your art, and you don't want to make mistakes in the creative process that could be avoided. And I think that when I watched those videos and was reflecting on what's happened with not only the prequels, but actually some of the stuff that happened with the original Star Wars movies. There is a lot of things that creative types, especially musicians, do a lot of the same mistakes. And I've done some of them myself. And so I thought it'd be fun with the release of Star Wars to talk about them, reflect on the Star Wars movies, and just have a good conversation. I mean, can't we just talk about Star Wars every once in a while? And I should say some ground rules, Chris, for this conversation. Like I mentioned, we don't know George Lucas. We're just kind of going off stuff that's publicly available. There's some movies that have been made, like The People versus George Lucas. I've seen that. He doesn't speak much in public, so there's not a lot of, like, you know, him talking about his thoughts on why he did things. I know that he just had a final falling out with Disney and is no longer going to be involved with the Star Wars enterprises at all. He made some kind of funny comments about that, and that we'll kind of bring up in a minute. But so it's just kind of interesting that an artist, somebody, you know, created something that had such a huge cultural impact, and then it just seemed like he's kind of just drifting off into obscurity while other people lead the charge for the original vision. And it's interesting to look at. So we're going to do that.
It just made me think of, like, I mean, Star Wars is on a level of the Beatles or Harry Potter, you know, these sort of monumental cultural touchstones, I guess, that many, many people in the Western world have kind of internalized in a way. And it would be like if the Beatles reunited and then, you know, put out some really questionable material.
It would be. So I've got, we're just going to dive in. I've separated a bunch of points into three different buckets of what creative people, musicians, can learn from the mistakes of George Lucas and the Star Wars movies. So my first one, and this is one that a lot of people probably don't know has been an issue, but my first one is to know when you're done. And point number one under that header is you can't get stuck in the past. You have to keep creating forward. And I know this is a huge issue for musicians who have a hard time just stopping, understanding that this season of music is done and I need to move on to the next season of music. And what most people don't know is that the Star Wars movies, the original Star Wars movies, is every time that they did a re-release in the theater, George Lucas would keep going back and keep tweaking it. Like, he was never satisfied with it. And
not just the re-releases in the 90s and 2000s, but you're just talking even back into the 70s, right?
Correct. There's all the every time it was re-released, he would go back and color correct it a different way. And there's actually a movement online to recapture and put together the film as it was originally made, because apparently it looks darker and has a different vibe. And you can go online and see images of, like, scenes of Tatooine from, like, the original early releases to theatrical releases over time to what happened with the special edition episodes. And Tatooine starts to look like candy compared to, at the beginning, it looks like this kind of moody desert. But then it becomes all this bright, all these color changes. And it's just interesting that, you know, in some of those very few interviews that he does, he refers to it all the time. He was never satisfied with it. And I'm like, the public, this is like one of the most recognized movies of all time. Why can't you be satisfied with it?
Yeah. And once it's done, let it be done, because it had such a successful impact on everyone who saw it and thought, and, you know, like, I was talking to my dad about it the other day. He went to go see it on opening night. He was on vacation in Cape Cod, and he went and, like, was blown away. He'd never seen anything like it before. And if you've had that much of an impact on someone, what do you need to change about it? Like, leave it alone and let it stand as a testament for what it was at that moment.
Yeah, and this kind of reaches its climax when the special editions were released, and some things, you know, especially with the original Star Wars, there's scenes where a bunch of junk, digital junk, gets thrown on top of another film, you know, on the original film, and it just doesn't work. And that's where some of the red letter media stuff in their videos where they show that. And it's like, that's where one of the things about creativity, they're talking about, you've got an audience, and whether it's music or a film, they're trying to follow along something. And then you've got on the screen just all this junk happening, and it becomes hard to follow along with what's happening. And that's one of my points from the next section. We'll get to that one in a second. But with creativity, you know, the you mentioned the Beatles, it would be kind of like, you know, if an artist can't just walk away from something, what would everyone do if Paul McCartney decided, hey, you know what, I really hated George Harrison's guitar parts on Abbey Road, so I'm going to go back and re-record them, and we'll release Abbey Road Special Edition. People would freak out. And that's kind of what, you know, happens as an artist if you don't just, you're kind of tampering with something that happened in a specific time and place. And that's one of my other points, is creativity happens in a specific time and place. The more you tweak, the more the tweaking becomes out of context, and it starts to hurt and not help. And then you're trying to manage this monster. And I actually, with Small Town Poets, with our album Listen Closely, when we were in the studio, there was some things happening to another artist on our label where their music just wasn't working. It was decided that it was because there's too many guitars on it. And so there was this pressure for us to not layer up a bunch of stuff, which is kind of funny when you think about how people layer music now with Pro Tools. And so when I left, when that album was done, there was always a couple songs where I felt like it was just empty and it needed some more. And I always wanted to go back and redo them. And then it was like last year, I listened to it with some fresh ears and thought, you know what? Sure, there's some things I would love to go back and add, but it's perfect. Because whatever was happening in my life and the band's life back then, and what I was feeling, and the sounds we were getting in that studio, there's no way I could recapture that. That's the thing that makes the music have an extra bit of power, and it becomes out of context. My playing over what's happening is no longer in context for the emotions that were happening at the time. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realize when they go back and start, you know, trying to keep tinkering with something that really was already done.
Sure. And if you put a new guitar lead on some song that you recorded 20 years ago or whatever, it's like, it's going to sound totally out of context, like the tones, everything.
And then you're going to go, now I need to fix those rhythm guitars. Now I need to go fix that.
It's like, yeah, it's never ending.
Yeah.
I feel like there's two aspects to the know when you're done, though. There's knowing when you're done before the thing is ever gone public, and then this sort of letting it be done and not going back and tweaking. And, you know, the musical equivalent could be constant remixing or remastering or whatever. But I think knowing a little bit about Star Wars history, like before it was released, the movie was a mess. Like,
yes, it was. There's
plenty of interviews with Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher saying, like, we were thinking the dialogue's terrible. We watched early cuts of the movie and it was awful. But Lucas somehow knew that it was not working beforehand, and sticking with it for a certain point and not letting it, you know, he didn't abandon it too soon. He worked and he got John Williams on to put the score. And so there was all this intensive reworking during that creative part of the process. But then once it was done, you know, he'd made it into something that was resonated. So I feel like there can be a bit of thinking too much during the creative process too, and I've been guilty of that plenty. So,
yeah, and I've talked to a lot of artists where they've said, okay, yeah, we released our debut album, you know, 6 months ago, a year ago, but we're not satisfied with it, so we're going to re-record it and re-release it. And I'm like, no, do not do that. unless you had a couple of hit songs on there that you've gotten feedback that, hey, we would have played this on radio, or we would have used this in film and TV, or we would have done with it if the quality was better, then that might be justification for doing so. But the reason why I would typically go, no, do not do that, is because instead of spending the next year building off of the creativity that you already had, now you're just spending the next year in an endless cycle because you've already done that. Now, what is better going to be in your mind? I mean, that's one of the things that artists, you know, what is going to make it better? When you look at the Star Wars, all those different color corrections, it's like, why did that color correction now make it better from the other four previous color corrected releases and little snips and tucks that you did the film here and there? It didn't change anything. And that kind of gets to my last point under this header of knowing when you're done, is that as an artist, you'll never be satisfied. So just accept the fact and use it to create more art. That's just how it's always going to be. We're artists. We're never going to be satisfied. And as an artist, you need to, I think one of the big career blockers I see people do is that they don't keep growing. They either have, you know, a little bit of success and it kind of stunts them because they kind of just linger in that little success and then it kind of fades and they haven't continued to move forward and build off of that and grow as an artist. And I'm talking on the creative side, not necessarily the business side. Or that they get hung up on, they released something and now they just want to keep going back to it. And like, no, keep moving forward. There's always going to be more things new things to write, new things to create, and you'll get better by creating new things and learning as you go.
Yeah. And just in George Lucas's favor here, I think he did do some of that for the original three movies, you know, like they each got visually more amazing. So whatever he was learning at the time, he was applying it to the next creation.
But, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he started Industrial Light and Magic and all these things. And I think that's where, that kind of leads us into the next bucket, which I have is technology. You get to a point where you're like, oh, now that I have Pro Tools, it would have been so much easier to go record that Small Town Poets record and all these plugins and things we could have done that we didn't have access to. And let's go back now and capture those ideas that we said, it wouldn't it be great if we could do this, but we just don't have the technology. Now we can. Now we can go do that.
Which could also lead you to the, what do they call it, the paralysis of choice.
Yes.
It could have taken you three times as long to record your album because suddenly, you know, every option is at your fingertips. So
yeah, and that's in the world of endless technology and endless options. One thing, I think another mistake that can be learned from some of the things that people really do not like about how the newer, the prequels turned out is, you know, sometimes less is more. And I was mentioned this briefly earlier, but there's a scene in Star Wars with the special editions where there's a scene, they're riding on the lights, the speeder, and you see them coming into Mos Eisley and you're following them. They're the main characters. I'm looking at them. And then with the special edition, suddenly there's all sorts of crap on the screen with things walking, blocking your view, and you no longer can even focus anymore, and you have no idea what you're supposed to be paying attention to. And that was a stark example of that. And then with the prequels, there's a lot of that going on where there's just so much junk happening on the screen all at once. I have honestly no idea what I'm supposed to be looking at.
Yeah, I watched those movies, the prequels, and I thought, there's no story here. There's no emotional charge. All this is a giant 2.5 hour commercial for Lucasfilm for their
Industrial Light and Magic.
Industrial Light and Magic commercial. I'm like, this is junk. It's just like a giant cartoon. And you said with the re-release of A New Hope, when they put all that sort of new junk on top of the Mos Eisley scene, there was such a stark contrast between what felt like a real world that had been created, you know, through tactile sets and whatnot, and then this digital fluff that was totally distracting. It's like so incongruous.
Yeah, and I think I'm a visual person, so when I saw that, they showed that in the Red Letter Media movies, videos. When I saw that, to me, it made perfect sense about how some people approach making music with Pro Tools and endless tracks, and that there's just so much junk happening at once that the listener's really overwhelmed and doesn't know what to listen to. There may be all these great melodies happening, but it's like it's really hard to know what's supposed to be the melody you're supposed to attach your, you know, kind of engage with, and just so much stuff happening, and that it's one of those things where you just have to go, less is more. I don't need more stuff happening. This isn't like, you know, it's really hard to recreate visually for a movie the idea of walking down a busy New York City street, because when you're looking at a film and you have an audience watching something, they have to know that, hey, these are my main characters. I'm trying to follow what they're doing, and I have to be able to see them and have some sort of connection with them. And so it's tough to kind of know where the line is of, and with music, just people will layer so much junk, and it's like, get rid of all those tracks.
Yeah, well, the other thing about dependence on technology, I forget if you mentioned it when we first brought this topic up, but there's the reliance on technology to fix things too, you know?
Yes.
Fix it in the mix, fix it in post, whatever art you're working on. Like, no, don't wait, because it's probably not going to be a great solution later. Fix it now. What's not working? Like, deal with it.
Yeah.
Does the melody suck? Well, just adding a bunch of string parts on top of that is not going to be super helpful.
Yeah, and one of my points was sometimes something isn't working because it doesn't work. You know, don't force it with technology. And I think if you watch some of the special features of the prequel Star Wars movies, there's a lot of things where they're like acknowledging problems, and instead of going, it's because there's a problem with the story or the characters aren't working, it's like, oh, we'll just throw more crap on top of it. And it's like, that doesn't solve the problem.
Well, and that's another good point, is what's at the heart of your art? Like, for Star Wars, yes, it was visually amazing, and it was a sci-fi film that, you know, broke a bunch of you know, made a lot of technical innovations. But really, the thing that sold it was that it was this sort of old mythic archetypal story told in a kind of Buck Rogers way. It was like a hearkening back to these very simple ideas. And so the same thing could be applied to music. What's at the heart of your song? Good lyrics, good melody, all the technical stuff you do on top of it, all the production, that's great as long as it focuses things back to what's most important. And I think with Lucas, with the prequels, it just, all there was technology, and there was no script, there was no character development, nothing.
Yeah. Well, and it goes back to what you were talking about, listening to The War on Drugs on repeat through your iPhone speakers. And it all starts with a good song. If you've got a good song, it's a good song. If all you have is production, that's, you know, some people get away with selling production. There's a lot of genres based around pretty much just production. But what connects people to your music is a good song, and you have to have that first if you want to see success from your music. Let's see, what else do I have under technology? I had listed the struggle in the process, and I think that's one thing that you see when you compare, like, recording back in, like, when we did recording the original Small Town Poets, our first two records, we were at Ardent Studios in Memphis recording to 2-inch tape. There was a lot of challenges if we wanted to try something, you know, production wise that we had to execute, and there was a struggle and really having to, like, get creative to make things happen. And I think that can, some of those limitations that cause you to struggle can provide better or more focused outcomes, as opposed to, you know, like sometimes in Pro Tools, it's just like, oh, I don't have to really think about it. It's kind of this mindless thing. I just use plugins to do whatever I want. And I think where that showed up in Star Wars is they created this amazing thing, like groundbreaking movie with visual effects that had never been done before, because they really had to struggle and fight for it and really make sure that if they were going to use it, it made sense for the story, and that it had the impact it needed, and it worked the right way. And, you know, you're basically all in on that. And then, you know,
because it cost them a boatload of money to make,
yeah,
whatever it was they were going to use. So,
Where now it's in the prequels, it's not like it was free, but it was much easier to just like, oh, let's just keep drawing more stuff on here. And it didn't cost. It was very low level commitments. So it's easy to make poor decisions when you have a low level of commitment on the execution of the idea. Where when you've got, you know, you have to decide whether or not it's going to make or break a project, then you know, your decision process is probably a little bit more rigorous.
Yeah. Do you remember that movie with Jack White and The Edge and Jimmy Page?
Yes.
I forgot what it's called, but...
It Might Get Loud.
So I always thought Jack White was kind of ridiculous in that movie, and he...
I did too.
As much as I love his music, I just thought he was kind of annoying, but... There's this one scene where he talks about how he really prefers picking up kind of broken or out of tune or, you know, these guitars that have a little bit of fight in them. Like, you know, you have to wrestle with them to get them to do what you want to do. And part of me thinks, well, that's dumb. Just get a good guitar and play it well. But then the other part of me thinks, like, I get that. Because when it's fighting back, you fight with it. Your mind gets into this kind of creative and energized state where the decisions you make are fueled with that kind of energy. And I think that energy is so present in the original Star Wars films, at least, I mean, especially A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. Like, there's so much of that. And then there's none of it in the prequels.
With technology, I've got one more that related is... that real magic happens when you put humans in a room together to react with one another. And this gets really highlighted in the Red Letter Media videos. They show the scene with, it's a young Obi-Wan Kenobi with General Grievous. It's in the second movie. And the actor is standing in a box of a room that's all green screen. They have nothing that they're interacting with. They don't know... You know, they can only go by what the description of what the filmmaker says is going to be going on. And it's the scene where General Grievous pulls out like all these lightsabers and they're spinning like blades. And the actor doesn't react to it, doesn't flinch, doesn't do anything because he doesn't know what's happening. He's not reacting to anybody. He's just playing a really flat character because he's standing in a green room by himself.
Which is such a squandering of Ewan McGregor's talents because he's such a great actor. If he had been in a room with another actor on a set, he could have brought his talents to that scene. And I think the same thing goes with music. You work with other people, bounce ideas off each other, be challenged, you know, have someone there telling you like, no, that guitar part sucks or whatever, you know.
Or even just how you play. I mean, this really came to light for me when Small Town Poets, we started making music again together, and we all live in different places. And so the first Christmas record we did, probably about 60% of it, I recorded the guitar tracks from home, and a good number of those guitar tracks I recorded before there were even final drums on some of them, and even before, I think in most cases for those tracks, there wasn't any final bass. And it really was a discovery process for me as an artist because I realized through that how I play guitar with Miguel, our bass player, is completely different than how I play guitar with other things I do with other players. And Miguel's such an amazing bass player. I mean, just such a great bass player that he really does a lot of melodic stuff and things that make it, you know, where me just holding a chord just sounds right. That's the right guitar part. I don't need to add all these melody things for some things when he's just got a really nice groove. But when I'm playing with other people that may play more simply or different, then what I do with the guitar is completely different. And that was one of those things that came to light that when I'm hearing and reacting to, you know, especially some of the people I collaborate here in Portland, one of them's Peter, who used to be here at CD Baby. He's a drummer. When the way he plays, he has a very distinct style, and I play very different when I'm playing with him. And I like noticing that, hey, when I've got this guy, it kind of makes this me do different things. And that's one of those things that I don't get when I'm just sitting at home recording tracks by myself to a click track. It just doesn't happen. And I think in this modern technology age that we're at, it makes it easy to create music if you can just swap files around, which I think is incredibly helpful. But there's still something to be said when you bring people in the room together to create something where it feels real, has humanity, and you're reacting to one another. And when we did our second Christmas record, that was one of the big things. I said, I want to be in the room with you guys. I want to do as much as we can together, playing down together. Even if I end up, recording tracks by myself, I want to have played songs with you so I can kind of feel how they feel with us as a band, as opposed to it's just layering us as if we're studio musicians.
Part of that group dynamic thing alludes to a sort of cliche bit of wisdom in the poetry world, which is no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. And so you as the artist need to be surprised. Otherwise, you're just going to be kind of dialing it in, trying to do a facsimile of what you think you have in your head. And a group dynamic in music helps you achieve that. If you are on your own making music, I think it's still important to try and do some things to stir it up and kind of go towards some unknown destinations to maybe introduce some of that surprise that you're missing because you're not working with other people. And then if you're in that setting too, where you're making music alone, bring other people in as creative consultants or mixing or whatever, just so you're not, you're getting feedback. You're not surrounded by a room of imaginary yes men who are in your mind telling you everything you're doing is great.
Yeah. And it's, if I had to say, what were the top 2-3 mistakes of the Star Wars prequels and what happened in the creative process that really ended up with a final product that the fans of the series ended up not liking what was created, I would have to say that the human element is one of the key things. When you've got, people standing in a green box trying to play characters, there's just no way you capture something that's supposed to connect with people on a human level. There's lots of movies that have used special effects in a way that where there is green screens involved and it's worked. Yes, there's plenty of examples of that. But in general, if that's how you're making most of your creative process, you're probably eliminating the ability for people to connect on a human level. And the thing is with like that human connection, it's not something people can easily describe. I could have lived with the idea of a lame character like Jar Jar Binks had there been the human emotion and connection with all the characters throughout the movies, but there wasn't. But instead of being able to identify that, most people go, well, I really hated that character, Jar Jar Binks. But
it's the one thing that stayed with them.
A lot of people probably didn't think is like, man, everything was flat. It wasn't like I cared about anybody. And that's when you know, if your music's just sounding flat and not really feeling like there's life in it, go back to putting everybody in the same room and play down the song together. Sure, it may not sound as produced and as slick as you can with Pro Tools, but so what? Maybe that's going to get you more fans because everybody's doing a slick production. So I think that's something to learn from that. And it's funny with the upcoming release of the new Star Wars movie that J.J. Abrams produced or directed. They had a whole little webisode about how we've put real people on real sets. So that's what like the narration is saying. And so you know that there was a lot of flack about the idea that, yeah, you can't have computer people fighting or, other computer people and expect people to feel a connection to it. So,
well, that kind of leads to our next point, I think, but in the J.J. Abrams, the new film, that specific trailer or whatever you'd call it, that was really focusing on the fact that they'd built sets and models and stuff as opposed to relying on CGI, really, I felt was relieving because I thought, oh, this guy knows what the original ones had and what the fans responded to, and he's trying to stay loyal to those expectations. And kind of revisiting that world that everyone loved instead of, whatever he could do with CGI today. But
Yeah, and that brings me to the last bucket of items, and that was managing fandom. My first point was you've created a specific world with your music. Your fans expect you to continue to work within that world. It's their point of context for you as an artist. Jumping to a different world without notice might have consequences. And, you know, you see artists who make drastic shifts in what they do and, you know, and it can grow on people. I think that's why, frankly, I'm still a big proponent of artists releasing music in album format, whether or not your fans engage with the whole album, and they just gravitate towards, you know, whatever single they want to add to their playlist or download or whatever. I think an album provides you with a greater context to say, hey, this is what I went away and I did this thing, and this is all related, and this will help you get into it more because this shows my growth as an artist, as opposed to here's just a random song where I used a disco beat and I normally have live drums and whatever. It's so,
yeah, in terms of creating a musical world and then your fans expect you to continue working within it, I can hear people saying, well, what about Dylan or what about David Bowie or Bjork or, you know, Elvis Costello, people who are constantly changing their musical approaches. But I think with all of them, there's still what's at the center. You know, Dylan, it's his voice and his lyrics. With David Bowie, it's maybe his voice and his melodies. Elvis Costello, it's his voice and his lyrics. Those things stay central regardless of what the instrumentation or the production style is. In the Star Wars movies, I think what was at the center, like I've already said, is that it's an archetypal story that's simply told and reinforced through visuals. With the prequels, there was no story. It was totally convoluted what the plot was and who the people were and why any of it mattered. And then there was, instead of being any of that being, you know, actually, I guess that was enhanced by the visuals because the visuals were equally convoluted and, and pointless. So maybe Lucas is a total genius. But anyways, what I'm saying is you can change musically as long as that thing that people really respond to continues to be offered to them.
And you can change musically completely. It just might have consequences with your current fan base. And, you know, that's why a lot of times artists will just like do something like, oh, this is my solo thing. And you're like, well, what's the matter? Is the band having trouble? I'm like, no, this is, you know, I wanted to do something different. And it's outside the world of my band. And I don't want there to be confusion. I want people to recognize, oh, this is something different. It's not, you know, his solo project that sounds like the band he's in. Where this relates to Star Wars is, you know, one thing to me that was so odd with the prequels when they came out is Star Wars has a very distinct look. And it's not even just how the films were made, but in the world that was created. And you're thinking, okay, this world is like sort of ragtag. It's kind of post technology. There's clearly still mega technology, but it's like
dilapidated.
Yeah, it's old. It's dilapidated. You got these rebels that are just kind of like bolting crap together to make stuff work. And it's, you know, it's kind of a Western, and it's, you know, it's the frontier, and it's out in the open. And so there's this visual language that's very strong. And then you go to the prequels, it's very slick. Nothing looks related whatsoever. It's in the city. It's very visually, it's like, is this even related? Okay, there's occasionally a stormtrooper that sort of looks like the ones. But the whole time I kept thinking, before the third movie came out, I was like, he's got a big problem with the movie making process here, because visually nothing makes sense leading into Star Wars. So how does the entire universe fall into decay in a matter of like 30 years? Because at the end of the other movie, you know, when Luke and Leia are born, it's like, you know, Star Wars, Luke's probably in his 20s. And it's like,
I don't even know if he's that old.
It's, yeah, like you're like
17 or 18. Probably.
So how does the whole universe suddenly change the way it looks? That just doesn't happen. And so it was,
and all of the technology of the ships, like reverted somehow too, because the ships that are in the prequels are so much bigger and brighter and
have a totally different design style.
Yeah, like, totally. Even if they became dilapidated, they would be the same dilapidated ships in the originals. But
to me, the other way I can make sense of it is when they went back to do The Hobbit, if it looked like New York City. You've got the Lord of the Rings trilogy. They're out in the wilderness. And then, oh, yeah, we're doing The Hobbit. And here he is in his apartment on the Upper West Side. And he's looking for the ring in Central Park. That's how stark of a contrast the two are, where it's like, how do these worlds even connect? And it's very disjointed of an experience to your fan. So I think with the creative process, that's something that you have to consider, that when you start building fans, they start relating to you under very distinct, both visual and, musically, some of the language that you've created and the world you've created. And when you step outside of those, if it's a drastic leap outside of those, you might lose your fans or have some repercussions that you didn't expect. And so,
sure. And another thing about understanding your audience too is, in the original Star Wars films, like within the first 20 minutes, Darth Vader, he strangles someone. A hairy looking walrus guy gets his arm cut off. What else? Like, real horrible stuff is going on. And then when the prequels come out, it's a kid's movie. There's Jar Jar and everything shiny, and there's a bunch of cute little robots.
But I should say that they didn't frame it as a kids movie. But when the backlash happened, they said, "Oh well, we've made it for kids." I'm like, "Really? This is a kids movie where in the third movie someone goes in and slaughters children in the Jedi fortress place? That's for kids? I wouldn't let my kids see that." Which I think goes to one of the other points I had here, is know who your audience is. Because I think going into something, and it's typically, artists are always like, how do I get my music to the next level? And how do I capitalize on the fans that I have? How do I get the fans energized in what I'm doing? And you have to know who your audience is. If you don't know who your audience is, or you do something where it's like suddenly they feel like you're not speaking to them anymore, you're probably going to alienate them. And that's exactly what happened with the prequels of the Star Wars movies. Whatever you think about them, if you've never seen the Star Wars movies and you saw the prequels first and you're like, oh, I thought they were fine, well, first go watch the Red Letter Media videos, and then tell me you like them after that. But then you got to learn the backlash, why it all happens, because like you felt like the audience was told that, hey, we're making something for you, and it was something for somebody else. And your audience isn't going to appreciate that. Hopefully you don't have a backlash like what happened with the prequels to the Star Wars franchise. But, I see it actually happen. We probably see it happen more often with how people communicate online. An artist will stand up and take a stand for some cause or release a song that's maybe a little bit more politically charged and get a backlash and think, I had no idea. I assumed because you liked my music, you all thought exactly the same way I do, and not realize that, the people that are gravitating to my music actually think these things. And maybe that's different than who I am. But it's just some of those, usually it's not the case, but it's some of those things that you have to consider who your audience is before you, especially if you're going out and making a stand on something, especially.
Before you go electric.
That's right, man. That's right. There's two musical comments on that come up. One, there's this band that I've liked that for years. When they first came out, they had a huge mega hit song, and their whole sound was more acoustic driven. It was kind of, they had some drums and stuff, but it was more acoustic. They were all playing acoustic guitars. And then they started, over the years, they would do a record that was all electric, and then another one that was maybe more acoustic. And it kind of became a disjointing experience for me as a listener, like, is this new album they're doing going to be a rock album that I like, or is it going to be an acoustic album that I don't care for? And it was just kind of interesting to see that play out. I think the latest Mumford & Sons, a lot of people have like, they've gone electric. I don't like them anymore.
Oh, I actually kind of finally enjoyed something they did.
Yeah.
I can't stand that acoustic four on the floor kick drum banjo thing. But I loved the, I don't love it, but I heard one of their new songs on the radio.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's a cool production. Yeah.
I don't mind the four on the floor acoustic banjo thing. I won't buy albums like that, but I appreciate some of their songs. But it's just that suddenly everybody did that, especially here in Portland. It became Banjo Beard Central. It was like, okay, that's played out. But the other thing, other musical comment was the new Coldplay album. You know, I liked Coldplay when their first album came out, and it was very much a band. And the last couple albums, especially the one before this one, I'm like, I just don't get it. I don't feel like the songs are there. I'm not sure what they're trying to do musically. It doesn't seem like they have a real strong direction. And then this new record seems like someone's been listening to a lot of disco records.
Right.
And I was left feeling that I'm no longer in their audience, I don't think. Who I am is no longer who they consider their audience. That's the feeling I had, and this just happened yesterday because I was listening. I was just like, huh.
It's like a song the one song I heard, it's like a Gwen Stefani, Adam Levine kind of tune.
Yeah, and the whole album's mostly like, I've listened to about 3/4 of it, but there's all these other vocalists on there and all these, it's like, I don't understand. I think I'm not their target audience anymore. Someone who just likes a rock band that writes catchy songs. So
you've aged out of Coldplay.
I've aged out, I guess. I have hit 41. So I have one more thing relating to managing fandom, and I think this directly, very much applies to what happened with the Star Wars, prequels. And why George Lucas, I think, from what I can tell, I think he was pretty offended by the reaction to it, or at least hurt. I don't know if offended is the right word, but probably hurt, because he felt like, he created this thing and suddenly it's not his thing anymore. And that's the weird thing I think about fandom, is that your fans' experience, especially as you become bigger and become... more established in their mind, your fans' experience is of you is not just about you anymore. Fandom becomes coming together over a common purpose. And I definitely saw this to a small degree with Small Town Poets, where we had these fans in the Wisconsin area, or they might have been Minnesota, but anywhere we played in that region, that north Midwest section of the United States, if we were within 5 hours driving, they would all come. And I noticed that a shift happened where, by the fifth, sixth, seventh show where they're doing this, their experience is more about them coming together and was less about us as a band. So it would be like, when their first couple times seeing us, they'd get excited if, they got there early and they got to talk to one of us. But then I noticed that it became more about them getting excited to see each other.
You're just the excuse.
We're just
point.
The vehicle to kind of, they're bonded over a common purpose. They love our music, but now it becomes about that community. And that's something that it can be unexpected that happens, is that suddenly your fans, a segment of them, their experience of you is about the community that they've built. And so when you start, ignoring them as a community or doing things that suddenly they don't identify with, it can be an interesting relationship that you suddenly have with those folks, where they feel like they have ownership in this thing now. And now you're tweaking our stuff here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that is a lesson for anyone that's creative. In a way, if you want your art to have an audience, it has to in part be about the other person. It has to be about the listener or the viewer. Not that that needs to totally determine how you make the art, but it needs to be in your mind that you're trying to make a connection, and that involves giving up ownership. because suddenly it is a dialogue, or you know, in an ideal world where you have a large fan base, it is a dialogue.
And I think more so than ever, and I think this is probably with the social media age, and this is probably where someone like a George Lucas would struggle. You know, when the original Star Wars trilogy was released, the only way people could see them was in the movie theater. They had no ability to even even take screenshots, archives, or photos. You know, you could probably, if you really wanted to, find a bootleg copy in New York City somewhere. But for the most part, that's the only way fans could experience it. And the way art and the fan community has evolved is that now there's people want to do things with your art as a fan that sometimes is creating their own art based off of what you've done. Sometimes it's doing derivative work. Sometimes it's just being able to freely spread your music or your art around with no repercussions, like having to pay royalties and all that. And so it's very interesting to see how the fans, when especially when you empower them, sometimes can really be the driving force behind your success. And that can be a challenge sometimes when those fans want to do something that maybe makes you uncomfortable or you didn't want them to do, or just the fact that they exist and want to do those things in the first place, where you feel like you're losing control. It's something that all the major labels and major media outlets have had to struggle with in the internet age, is like going, okay, it's cool that we let people, everyone in the building, video the concert with their cell phone and post it on YouTube, where it actually helps us. It doesn't end the world and destroy the ability of us to make money off of our copyrights, and realizing that, hey, these people are involved, and when we get them involved, they really can, they want to do stuff with it, and it's their own community that's driving it forward, you know?
Yeah, and no matter how many times you file copyright notices to YouTube to have them remove instances of the Star Wars Christmas special, your fans are still going to keep uploading it because it's just that great.
I need to go watch that. I always forget that existed. Someone brought that up a couple years ago, and they played it. I'm like, oh, I remember seeing that as a kid.
And isn't Bea Arthur in it?
I don't remember. It's like a family of Wookiees.
Family of Wookiees, and the stormtroopers come.
Yeah, it's just so, so.
And there's a couple disco numbers, I think.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. The last point I had, and this kind of falls outside of one of those three buckets, and you kind of mentioned it, is that it's important that you surround yourself in the creative process with people that you can trust to give you honest feedback. Your mom off the list. It's great that you know, to get that unconditional positive reinforcement, but they're not the ones that are going to give you good, honest feedback about, I don't think this quite works here. When you played that song for me the first time, I liked it a whole lot better than the way it came out on how you're going with it now. I mean, it's good to find some key people that you can trust that will give you honest feedback when something is going wrong.
That Red Letter Media video does a good job of showing Lucas surrounded by, I mean, they paint it as a bunch of yes men who basically are just so thrilled to be involved in a Star Wars project that they never really stopped to say, hey man, that script doesn't make any sense, or what, you know, whatever the problem was.
Yeah, nobody wants to be the guy that's going to the boss after he hasn't made a film in years and relaunching a mega franchise. No one wants to be the guy that says, hey, this just isn't working. And there's a scene that from the special features on the DVD that show this happening, and it's pretty entertaining. They watch it, and they got this horrified look on their face, and they're like, no one wants to talk. And George Lucas finally says, huh, I think we may have gone too far. But if we start peeling things off, then we have to basically redo the whole thing. And nobody wants to say anything. And it's like, you can tell that he hasn't, you shouldn't get to that point in the creative process, on especially something that you're putting a lot of money into. You know, if you're just making demos at home, or if you fully track at home and have the ability to make good sounding records at home, it's low risk, you know, do what you want. But if you're actually going in the studio, spending a lot of money, and it's going to be like, hey, this is all I'm going to be able to do until I, you know, make enough money to do this again, it's probably good to get some people that can, that can be a good sounding board along the way, so you don't end up at the end going, I just blew $5,000 or $10,000 making this record and it sucks because I made all these mistakes. So that's something that I think artists probably don't have enough of in their life, of people that are going to give them good, honest, encouraging feedback. You know, I've yet to release music that my mom told me she didn't like. So I'm very appreciative of all those people in my life that just encourage me no matter what. But
my parents listened to my new album a couple weeks ago and they were like, yeah, it sounds great. We like it. Go. Thanks.
Yeah. And they're just, you know, they like your music, but they're a fan of you. And that's why they want to be supportive and encouraging. But also it's people that understand the creative process and know, like, you know, that's why it's good. I think still a lot of folks have been using producers less and less because, you know, I can record at home or I can do a lot of it myself. But I think it's important that those kind of people provide a good guiding role and help you shape something and draw better outcomes out of yourself. So,
well, I have one really, really pressing musical question about Star Wars.
Yes.
Now that Disney owns it, what's going to happen to the 20th Century Fox music before the that part?
That's a good question.
Like, I don't want to watch a Star Wars movie that doesn't start with the snare drum roll.
Yeah, you know, it was when I was a kid and I first saw Star Wars. I saw it. I don't remember what year it was. I saw it. It was in one of the re-releases because I forget what year it originally came out of. But I would have been too young to remember.
A New Hope, I think, was 77.
That's what I thought, yeah. I was born in 74. And so I know I didn't see it when I was 3, but I think I saw it like when I was... I think they re-released it right before Empire Strikes Back came out, like the year before or something, and so I saw it then. But I remember having my mind blown, and I couldn't... every time that 20th Century Fox thing came on before a movie, I thought... Star Wars. And I'd be like, what? What the heck is this? This isn't Star Wars. They use that for other movies.
The biggest letdown.
I know. I'd be like, oh my gosh. Especially if it was like some romantic comedy. I'm like, you really just let me down here. But
did the prequels have the...
Yeah, they did.
I'm
pretty sure they did. I don't know. The one thing I do know is that there will be Star Wars for years to come. There will be episodes 7, 8, and 9 already in production. They have the prologue that they're doing called Rogue One. First installment, I think that's a 2-movie thing. The first installment of that will be next Christmas. That's supposed to be what happens between episode 3 and episode 4 with the stealing of the Death Star plans. And so there'll be lots of Star Wars to come. So,
and a Han Solo origin film?
Yeah. All sorts of good stuff. And I think to tie up the Star Wars thing, because we actually do have a couple of listener calls if that I think are good and we want to use. And this might be our record longest podcast ever. But it's Star Wars, so hopefully everyone's still hanging in there. It was interesting to see, you know, kind of the closing of the chapter with George Lucas and the Star Wars series. This just happened a couple weeks ago. He issued a statement of how nobody he was brought on as an advisory role for the making of the new film, and he said he was basically marginalized and pushed out. No one wanted to listen to his ideas, and he gave tons of feedback and didn't like lots of stuff. And he said that, you know, they're just making movies for the fans, and this is really a family drama, and it needs to be treated as such. And so I'm stepping away, and my involvement with Star Wars is basically over. And it was kind of, you know, kind of like a, whoa, George, let's talk, buddy. What's going on?
Testy, testy.
And so he pretty much walked away. And I think that what was interesting about it is that, I don't know how much, you know, it's a pretty brief statement. You know, like I said, he has not made a lot of public statements. Even his interviews that I've seen over the years, he doesn't say a lot about, you know, some of the bigger questions that the fan community may have. But I thought the interesting thing was, it's like, okay, they're making a movie for the fans. And I was like, well, who were you making movies for? And then him saying it's a family drama, I'm like, well, the way he's describing it, I'm like, what did you do with those first three, the prequels? It's like that is, you know, all this character, it was devoid of character development in a story that's about someone becoming Darth Vader, which should have been all character development, you know, and the struggle and all this stuff. But it was just, it was really all about spaceships and lightsabers, as many as you could get on the screen. And so it was just, when he said that, it's kind of like, does he know what made his movies great? That's what I started wondering, like, how do you get to that point and make that statement? And then looking back on the work that you've done, and it seems like it's just totally opposite of what he did. And so yeah. It was just weird. It was just like, this is a case of an artist not understanding why people are connecting with his art. And I don't, you know, with film, you would think there's a little bit more insight because it's a pretty plain story. But it was just kind of an interesting thing. The last thing was that he has seen the new movie and apparently he likes it and will be at the premiere next week.
Oh, so everything works out. When you were saying, does he even know who his fans are? It reminded me of my favorite moment from the Red Letter Media series, where they show the opening scene from A New Hope, where there's the tiny little rebel ship that goes by, and then the giant, giant Star Destroyer coming in overhead, and the guy's narrating. He says, with this one shot, he establishes the power dynamic of the universe. He shows us the menace and the overreaching arm of the Empire, blah, blah, blah. In fact, it's such a brilliant shot that I don't believe George Lucas could have thought of it.
Yeah, that is funny. And that was one of those things that I'm like, where I was thinking, if I had a film class, I would make everybody watch this, because that is like, visually, you see this little ship that's on the run, this giant Star Destroyer that fills the whole screen following it. And it's like, it just feels hopeless that there's no way that that little ship can get away, and just how it's coming down from the top of the screen. And it just, yeah, you're right. You don't need to say anything. You establish that whoever's in that ship is screwed. Whoever's in this one's clearly in power. And there's just a lot of things that you can get from just that simple shot. Yeah. That is funny. I go back and watch those every once in a while, and it just makes me laugh so hard.
And then cry.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's things like changing the nature of characters, like going back and tweaking him, how he changes. You know, Han Solo's a bad boy. He's the one that's going to pull the gun and shoot first. And he, for whatever reason, changed that scenario. And it made no sense why you would go back and screw that up. I don't know. It's weird. Creativity is weird. And what we do as artists is weird. And what we think about our own art, it's sometimes, I don't know. It's
incorrect. It's,
yes. Well, I feel better now. We've talked about Star Wars on the podcast.
It's very cathartic.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to this new movie.
Yep, I am as well. But before we close out this podcast, we do have some calls I want to get to, and we're going to play them right now.
Hey, Kevin, this is Rennie. First off, thank you so much for existing, guys. And first time caller, just started listening to the podcasts. My question has to do with parodies. I listened to episode 91 on taking a cover song and doing it the right way with the licensing and whatnot. And the question I have is, how do you deal with parodies in a similar fashion? I know there's a lot of gray area, and specifically in my case, I co-authored a parody off of a Beatles tune, A Day in the Life of A Day in the Life is actually the title. We've called it A Day in the Life of an Application Developer. And we actually won an award for this. It was a song combination with a music video that also was combined with a paper that we wrote. And we're really proud of it. And we're excited, except that we've got some issues with YouTube taking it down recently, because there's a part of the audio that is recognizable. And just as a quick backstory, we use a karaoke version of the actual instrumentation underneath, and exercising what we thought was parody law after having done some research and talking to YouTube lawyers and whatnot and thinking we were on the up and up. So the underlying instrumental track is the same, but we completely changed the lyrics, which means we also were involved with the vocals. So that's all our addition. The music video was pretty cool. So we're a little frustrated, but willing to learn, hoping you guys have some cool answers for us, because it was a huge labor of love that has now been yanked from YouTube. So we'd love to see it back and see how we could do this legitimately. Would love to hear from you guys. Thanks a lot, Kevin. Bye.
Thanks for the call, Rennie. Rennie, parody is a gray area, like you mentioned, and typically it's pretty easy to tell a parody from the real thing. It sounds like the song that you were doing is a straight up parody, and no one would argue that. But where you went wrong was you used a karaoke track. And the reason it got pulled from YouTube is that their content ID system will recognize that, and whoever owns those karaoke tracks has their setting set to block all content that uses them. So you cannot use karaoke tracks. YouTube's pretty strict on karaoke tracks, because I think most of the karaoke providers don't want their karaoke tracks just getting used by someone else without paying the proper royalties. So you are using someone else's master recording, and that's where you went wrong. If you had recorded the tracks yourself, you would have been perfectly fine, and I doubt you would have had any issues. But because you used a karaoke track, you got into problems. So don't use karaoke tracks.
Another issue could be the, are we assuming that fair use comes into play, or...
That's, you know, it was a day in the life. They changed it to a day in the, I forget what the, you know, it was a funny version of a day in the life of the Beatles song, A Day in the Life, and they changed it to be humorous. And so that should be fair use. But again, with parody, it is a gray area. You know, Weird Al's been sued multiple times. I know he had a lawsuit from Coolio that he won. Weird Al won, but parody can be subjective, so people might still come after you, even though you're well within your rights. Thanks for the call. I hope that helps. And if you re-record your tracks, it should be fine. Let's go on to the next call. This is from, I think he said his name's Tricky.
Hey guys, my name is Tori, or Tricky Dozier. I'm a musician here in California, and I've been playing with a number of bands out here, and even won a LA Music Award on my own, and then won a couple with a couple of bands that I was in, and had, you know, a little bit of success. I'm a Christian artist, but now I'm going out on my own. I'm finding that working with bands is like totally crazy. So, but I'm actually almost done writing and recording a straight all ukulele CD, and but it's like, you know, different. It's different than the probably some of the norm ukulele stuff. Like, I'm doing some Prince on there. I've covered a Prince song, and you know, I've covered some other stuff. But anyway, I just discovered your podcast like maybe a month ago or something, and it is amazing. Thank you so much. I listen to it while I'm at work. And so my question is, what is the first 5 things somebody should do when their CD is done? I'm writing down all these notes from your podcast and stuff as I'm working and everything. Just amazing stuff. You guys are awesome and amazing. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thanks for that call. Chris, I think this is kind of I don't know. It's coincidence.
It's timely.
Timely.
It's the type of question that we're not quite going to answer yet, right?
Yeah, we recorded an episode of the podcast at the DIY Musician Conference where the topic was the top 5 mistakes artists make when releasing an album. So I know he wasn't asking about the top 5 mistakes, but I think that points to the top 5 things you should be doing. And so we will be releasing that shortly. I've got a handful of podcasts done that I'm going to start cranking out.
I'm pretty sure when we recorded that for each of those items, it was like, here's the mistake. Now here's the proactive thing you should be doing instead. So it's basically his question in reverse.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's coming up. I think you'll enjoy it. There are things that many, many artists make, ourselves included, and there are things that can be easily avoided. And so, yeah, that'll be coming up shortly, and we hope that that answers your question. So, again, if you want to call our listener line, it's 360-524-2209. Tell us your thoughts, comments, your feedback. If you want to weigh in on how much you loved the prequels or how much you hated the prequels, how much you loved the Star Wars episode, how much we were thought we were off our rocker, you can do so, and we will weigh in. And I will put a link to the Red Letter Media videos. Again, they are not safe for work. They're not, you know, visually there's nothing that's offensive, but it is, you know, a kind of a salty character. And so it's not something you want to gather the family around with young children and watch. But, you know, it is, I would say, R-rated, PG-13.
Did you say that he was a salty character?
Yeah.
He's also an assaulty character.
That's true. I totally forgot about the serial killer thing. Once you actually, the people that are listening to this haven't seen him yet are probably like, what is wrong with these guys? Once you see it, you'll get it. It is totally for comedic value, and it actually makes the videos more entertaining the way this character talks and how the editing, how they do some quick edits that are just kind of funny. But I will say, especially the ones about the Phantom Menace, where they really talk about how Lucas was reestablishing the Star Wars universe in a different way, and how it was all just not working. I think there's a lot of comparisons there that really will make you understand where we're coming from when we're looking at creativity and seeing someone's creative process and how something worked and then something that didn't. But anyway, do you have tickets to see the new one yet, Chris?
I do. I supposed to go next weekend.
I as well.
I'm really excited, and then I've also just prepared myself for disappointment after the last 16 years.
Honestly, they could just fly the Millennium Falcon around for 2 hours on the screen, and I'd be perfectly happy. Even that's a step above what I experienced with Phantom Menace. I was just with Small Town Poets last weekend. We were playing a show, and we were talking about that we were bummed that we couldn't all be together to watch the movie to undo the injustice that we suffered together that fateful night.
When I was talking with my dad that I mentioned our conversation about his being blown away, what I didn't mention is that in the next seat over, my mom was sleeping. So this is in 1977, and this revolutionary movie that totally amazed my dad, my mom was completely indifferent to, and she fell asleep after like 15 minutes.
That's funny. Yep. It can happen. It's not for everyone. It's not for everyone. So, all right. Well, we'll put a link to those videos we mentioned in the podcast notes. And you can also email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. You can leave comments in the comments section. You can always find me on Twitter, and Chris, you're on Twitter as well. I'm at K Bruner. You're at Chris Robley. Is that what it is?
Yep. R-O-B-L-E-Y.
And my last name is B-R-E-U-N-E-R. And we're there. You can tell us whatever you want. We will usually respond. And that's going to do it. So how do we end a Star Wars episode?
Let's see. Something like that.
Perfect. That's the end right there.
See ya.
All right. We'll see ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.